This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Between and after the party conventions, reporters will be following candidates across the American landscape and trying to grasp the mood of the nation along the way. And while one can learn a lot from the rope line campaign rallies and opinion polls, sometimes the picture of the country comes across more clearly in stories a lot smaller than national elections, in under-the-radar stories that sometimes don't make it beyond a few paragraphs in the national roundup section of the newspaper. The New Yorker magazine has assigned two writers to collect these stories over the past 30 years in a column called U.S. Journal. Its current author, Mark Singer, writes about cockfighters in Oklahoma, snowmobilers in Montana, and skinny dippers in Vermont, and tells of the struggles of these wildly diverse Americans to hold on to something important to them in what he describes as a land of deep unease. His tales from the road are collected in a new book called Somewhere in America, Under the Radar with Chicken Warriors, Left-Wing Patriots, Angry Nudists, and others. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Mark's predecessor on the U.S. Journal column, Calvin Trillin. Later in the program, and I'm sure Mr. Trillin wouldn't mind, the subject shifts to food, or more precisely, cooking, for presidents, prime ministers, and princes. We'll talk with three of these chefs of state who are gathered here in Washington, D.C., but first, Somewhere in America. What are the small stories that you think illuminate some aspect of this country? We want to hear what traveling has taught you about the country you call home, or maybe you have a story from your hometown. Join the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Mark Singer now joins us to talk with us about his new book. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be with you.
A lot of these stories seem to be about people fighting pitched battles over what seem at a distance to be small issues. Why are you attracted to these?
Well, I'm attracted to something that people have passion for. Why are people attracted to politics? You know, it's all politics is local. All these local stories are intensely felt, and that's really the friction point where you can find out a lot about the country, I've discovered, by going to a place where something has happened where that seems to be a local story but really has a broader resonance, and just reporting it for a few days and trying to not really make it connect to some grand theory, but just how do people's lives moved by these intense local events?
Tell us a couple of these. You begin with a story from your home state in Oklahoma, a story about cockfighting.
Well, there's been a battle in Oklahoma over cockfighting for the last several years. I think it's even now ambiguous whether it's legal or illegal. Why people continue to have cockfights is, I wasn't really there to judge that. I was just interested in the fact that there was this quaint custom, and there was a, I was interested in the fight over cockfighting more than cockfighting itself.
And the fight typifying, what was it about? I mean, obviously it's about cockfighting, but you seem to suggest it's something about something deeper.
Well, as far as the people in Oklahoma who were cockfighters were concerned, it was about nothing that was anybody else's business. They had these various cockfighting pits in different rural parts of the state. They were, as far as they were concerned, doing what they enjoyed doing. It wasn't up to the Humane Society or any government to tell them what to do. And legislature there is still, you might say, in the grip of sort of rural logic. So it was very hard, actually, to get politicians to say that they were really strongly opposed to cockfighting. It ironically turned out being an issue in the last gubernatorial election and sort of determined it in an odd, indirect way. And subsequently, I mean, the people were opposed to cockfighting, but the cockfighters didn't really care what the people thought. They were, you know, the cockfighting was legal, but when you go to a cockfighting pit, you thought you were sort of at a speakeasy. It was all very obscure.
You describe a guy you meet named Anthony Villalobos. He recalled that he and a few fellow tricksters mingled with petition gatherers. And he says, if you want someone harassed in the Tulsa area, I'm in a coordinated fashion, I'm the man to see.
He was the Tulsa area harassment coordinator, he said, and they would do things like going to places where there were people opposing cockfighting, holding up signs, and they would hold up signs that said "ban fishing" and "outlaw hunting." It was dirty trickster kind of stuff from the cockfighting lobby. They were fairly sophisticated. There was a lot of money involved in it from their point of view too.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, gambling was one thing, but just there was prize money, and it was It was a lucrative business for some people.
Well, they see it as a way of life.
It is, and that's really what I've been drawn to, as you pointed out at the beginning. I looked for stories around the country that are not stories that are going to be reported. Sometimes they get reported by places like National Public Radio, but they're really stories that I find by reading newspapers online, reading state and local pages, looking for things that aren't going to be reported in the broader press, and getting lucky sometimes.
And the underlying theme of a lot of these stories, and this one is about the cockfighting story we were talking about and the dirty tricks you were describing, such stratagems wouldn't have been necessary, you wrote the cockfighters say, if their adversaries hadn't stooped to various forms of carpet bagging, including soliciting assistance from subversive organizations like the Humane Society of the United States. And it sounds funny, but a lot of this is, you know, this weariness or this wariness might be a better word of outsiders in a story about racism in a town called Martinsville, Indiana, in another part of the book. Seeing the name of their town and the KKK in the same context invariably evokes a complex reaction from the town's loyalists, a mixture of anger, frustration, denial, and weariness, nourished by a suspicion that the rest of the world is inexplicably determined to punish Martinsville for transgressions it had nothing to do with.
Well, that was a story about a murder that had taken place in 1968 of a black woman, an unsolved murder. This piece was published in early 2002. Martinsville was a town where there were no black people living. It was an all-white town, and the longer this murder remained unsolved, the more the perception, particularly in other Indiana towns, was that Martinsville was this racist place. It sort of let them off the hook in some sense. It made them think that they were not guilty of this. In fact, when one looked at the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana, it was ubiquitous, especially in the 1920s, and Martinsville was no different from any other smaller, middling-sized Indiana town. But they got stuck in the 1960s and all through the end of the century, really, with this stigma of this murder. The murder actually was subsequently solved. Right? Long, 2 or 3 weeks after my piece was published, the murderer was uncovered.
Hmm. Call us or email us with your stories of what you've seen in America, in little town newspapers, or in your town that you think illustrates something important about America. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Karen, who's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi. I wanted to tell you briefly about a trip I took in 1986 to try to write a book about both the Route 66 TV series and the road itself, where we kept trying to follow Route 66. It would end up in a dead end by a cemetery full of cows, and interviewed George Maharis, where he talked about the difference between the America he traveled through on the TV series and the America that where we sat at Denny's and did the interview. He said, when he was traveling around in 1960, 61, 62, it was all different places had their own character. He said, now you can go anywhere you like, and it's a Denny's.
George Maharis, of course, was one of the co-stars of the TV show Route 66 back in those days that you're talking about, Karen.
That's correct.
Yeah. As you travel around, Mark Singer, you get that homogenization of America that Karen's talking about?
Oh, it's a great problem, and it's sort of, as a reporter, you look for the blue highways, I guess, that old William Least Heat Moon book, and I think the largest city I've done a story from in the last 4 years is Cincinnati. They've been from places like Shreveport, Norfolk, Connecticut, Lee, Massachusetts, Cook City, Montana, Asheville, North Carolina. And when you go there, you nevertheless find that there is the Denny's, there is the Walmart, there is a great deal of homogenization of the landscape. And that is an inevitable problem, but in most cases, that's not what I'm there looking for. I'm never there looking for that. I'm looking for the truly indigenous local event.
And there are smaller towns that are completely dropping off of maps. We went through towns where they said that that their town had been on the Rand McNally map the year before, but they lost population. They no longer qualified to be on the map because they'd been bypassed by the interstate. And one morning we came out of a hotel in Dublin, Texas, just in time to watch the hotel across the street being knocked down by a bulldozer.
The depopulation of the Great Plains, among other things, all things considered, did a terrific story, a couple of weeks ago about towns that were being taken off the Greyhound route.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Karen, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye.
Joining us now from his vacation home in Nova Scotia is the man who originated the U.S. Journal for the New Yorker magazine, Calvin Trillin, and good to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
You wrote this column back in the 60s and 70s. What were the issues back then that got your attention?
Well, I think that I started in 67 and I did it until 82. I don't think I started with the idea of the subjects of the pieces. I started with the idea that in those days, as you may remember, the pieces in the New Yorker were very long.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there were things that I wanted to do that just didn't require that sort of treatment. And I also felt with those long pieces, doing three or four or five of them a year, I was sort of losing touch with things. And so I was interested in what I think when I worked at Time, we used to call regional stories, that is, the stories that didn't make the national press. And in those days, the stories that made the national press say from a place like Indiana would be either a natural disaster or a presidential primary, something like that. Otherwise, in some ways, I sort of felt I had the country to myself, and that there weren't very many outlets before, of course, cable and various other before some of the local papers, weekly papers that. Not very many people were interested in that sort of story.
Mark Singer, I know that one change you instituted, or at least your editor instituted, when you started or restarted the U.S. Journal column, was you weren't going to put up with any of Calvin Trillin's one story every 3 weeks nonsense.
Now, that was a terrifying notion to me. I say in the introduction of the book that he did that from 1966 to 82, once every 3 weeks, taking off in the summers, and it was a combination of Lou Gehrig or Cal Ripken Jr.'s sort of Iron Man performance with a few of DiMaggio's highlights thrown in. It was nothing that I was going to try to replicate.
Well, I appreciate that, but it's odd that magazine people used to say, my God, how can you keep up that schedule, and newspaper people would say, what else do you do? I mean,
well,
they thought it was sort of a hobby I did on the side.
Well, one of the other things you did was search out some good places to eat, but what stories would you want to do search out today if you're still doing this, the column, Calvin?
I think the same sort of stories, and some of the stories that Mark does are just the sort of stories that would have appealed to me. The way the thing is slugged in the New Yorker, it says, say, U.S. Journal, Martinsville, Indiana, and then the title underneath, something like that. But I always thought that I went to the story rather than the place, but that if the piece worked, it was because you got the context of the place in the story, and that it wasn't just a murder, but it was a murder that happened in a county in Iowa, and it told you something about the county in Iowa as well as the murder. And so I think the same sort of stories. I was drawn, I think, to a certain extent to controversy and change. I was often in a place where people were arguing about one thing or another, either development or tenure or a labor dispute. I also was drawn to, and I think Mark is too, to one part of society rubbing up against another in some way that gave off sparks that might be interesting.
We'll hear more of those stories and more of your calls and emails when we come back from a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, we asked for your best photos from the road. Thanks to all of you who responded. Five of our favorites are up on the Talk of the Nation page at www.npr.org. Right now, we're talking about a rather wrong-running road trip, the New Yorker's U.S. Journal column. With us are Mark Singer, the column's current occupant. He's in our bureau in New York. And from Nova Scotia, the column's originator, Calvin Trillin. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go to Greg, who's with us from Indianapolis.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wanting to bring to the attention a good American story about how here in Indianapolis, the mayor is going to let a corporation, Simon Property Group, have a large portion of a city park that was built back in the 80s for little or no tax reparations, and how it's just really, created a controversy that really has divided the city, just like the presidential elections have the rest of the country.
How would you characterize the two sides, Greg?
Well, there's sides that would really want the mayor to give that to the company so that they could create 200 to 300 jobs, I believe the number was, and then there's the side that doesn't want the city park that has been here for over 15 years to be paved over and an office building built upon it.
Is it getting a lot of coverage?
Not really. I read about it in the Indianapolis Star, and it had not even a front page ad. It was in the back page, only a couple paragraphs long.
Mark Singer, you taking notes on this?
I am indeed. I'm in your debt, Greg. Thank you very much. That's exactly the kind of story that one looks for. And as you point out, it's not highly played in the newspaper, and they deserve attention that they're not getting.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. Ed is with us, and Ed's calling from Kansas City, Missouri.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Ed.
Hey, I was just going to comment on the number of Hispanic and particularly the bilingual newspapers that I've seen popping up. Kansas City has had one for a long time, and they've really brought to light some interesting articles over the years.
And do you read them carefully, Ed?
Yes, usually I do. And the thing I like about them is they kind of help bridge the communities together, because they are writing in English and Spanish. And where normally if something's written in Spanish, someone who does not speak Spanish will look at it and not understand what it's about and sometimes not care. When it's written in two languages, it gives kind of an opportunity for both communities to understand the issues.
Is that a resource you use, Mark?
I haven't, but I'm going to now. This is this is time well spent for me today. I happen to be writing right now a story from South Texas that's about a clash between bilingual and Anglo culture, but I found it in off of a wire service, not in a bilingual paper.
Calvin Trillin, the number of papers in Spanish, that's new, but certainly a lot of languages in America when you were writing.
Yeah, actually, I did a piece, I can't remember when, but it was in Crystal City, Texas, the spinach capital of the world, a place that has a statue of Popeye in front of City Hall, or used to, when the Spanish-speaking people finally got enough votes to take over the school board and caused a lot of controversy by banning Army recruiters from the school, since they thought it was just Hispanics that were being taken to fight, and having a translation of the halftime events in Spanish, which infuriated the local Anglos. But that was, even then, a fairly typical kind of story to do.
Ed, thanks very much.
Do you remember how you found that story?
I'm sorry?
I was wondering if he remembered how he found that story.
I don't. I had often a lot of difficulty finding stories, since the New Yorker didn't even have, and still doesn't have, even a wire service machine, and there wasn't any internet, and there wasn't any LexisNexis, and I used to go down to Times Square, where in those days there was
an out-of-town paper newsstand.
I remember it well, yeah.
Hotelings, I can't remember how you pronounce it.
Hotelings, I think.
Hotelings, and get a huge pile of papers, most of which had the same wire service stories from Washington all through them. And I would say about 99% of no use to me, but at least it made me feel like I was doing something to find a story. And I particularly liked the Des Moines Register because they had a little map of Iowa next to any Iowa story to show you where it was. So you could go through very quickly and see where the local stories were. But it was, finding a story was a problem for me. Sometimes it was easy, and I did it in what we called in my house the off week, between the week of reporting and the week of writing. And sometimes the off week was sort of relaxed, and sometimes it was harder than the other 2 weeks.
Let's get another caller in. Nate joins us from Morrisville, Indiana. A lot of calls from Indiana today.
Hello.
Hi, Nate. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I went through the Martinsville school districts, and I was just wondering if the writers, in researching their stories, and when they put this out on to the nation, essentially, I know that Martinsville kind of regressed itself. It seems like it's more of a protected community, and its growth in terms of business and even subdivision expansion seems smaller than other towns that are around it by comparison. And I wondered if these guys had ever gone back and done follow-up and seen the kind of impact that their stories have had.
Mark Singer?
I tend not to go back and do the same, to follow up the story explicitly. I did put that story in a book, and I did a postscript in which I described how the murder had been largely solved. I hear from people in Martinsville when I publish something like that, and I heard certainly from them and got their reaction, but I generally want to keep moving.
Yeah, I would agree, and there's a sort of a technical problem with doing a follow-up story, is that you can't count on anybody who reads your new story having read the old one. So you have to do a certain amount of recapping, and then for the people who already read that, I mean, it's just a sort of a tiresome technical problem. And I once or twice went back to places where I had done stories, the Watts Towers in Los Angeles, for instance, and I didn't feel that the follow-up story was a very successful story, so I tried to avoid it.
Is there any danger of thanks very much for the call, Nate.
Thank you.
Is there any danger of condescension in the whole premise of this idea of a writer for a prestigious New York magazine goes out to discover America and put these exotic creatures on some sort of a microscope slide?
Oh, boy. That's something I thought about a lot before I did it, and I suspect Mark has thought about it a lot, too. I'm from Kansas City, and Mark is from Tulsa, and I've never talked about this with him, but I think I would have never thought of doing this if I had been raised in New York and thought of the rest of the country as some sort of exotic place. If I hadn't been writing about people I had grown up with, I was worried about that always. And in fact, I noticed when I had to go back and read a piece that was in Mark's home state about Muskogee's submarine, when Muskogee got a submarine, I noticed that all through there, I hadn't read the piece in years, and I guess I was looking for something. I found myself talking about Lake Lackawanna in Kansas City, which is the biggest body of water near Kansas City when I was a little boy, and I realized I was saying all the time, "Hey, it's okay, it's just me. You don't have to worry about this." But because that piece was what I would have thought of as a sort of a borderline piece where I really avoided anything, and I think Mark does too, that could be thought of as what later became called kitsch or something that was just sort of funny because it was so unsophisticated or something like that.
Mark, did you want to respond to that?
Well, I would have said myself if I had answered the question first that he's from Kansas City and I'm from Tulsa, and that pretty much explains how each of us enjoy doing this beat. Living in New York City, the thing you want to do most if you're not from there is to go back where you came from in some sense, and this is a perfect way to do it. Also, I think that if you do anything condescending like that, even once, but certainly as a routine, you've lost your credibility as a reporter. People are just not going to talk with you, and so one's fairly scrupulous about avoiding any sort of tone of that sort. Yes, you're from the New Yorker, but basically when you approach people to talk to them, you're approaching them as an individual.
Let's get another caller on the line. Rusty's with us from Decatur, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi.
We're talking about American Dreams and in the paper.
Yeah.
But I do floors for a living, a tile, a linoleum, vinyl, carpeting, and I'm in nice homes all the time. Right now I'm putting in linoleum on a cottage on a lake. When I would go home, I would be depressed that I would want one of these dream home twos, but they were always out of reach. And one day I bought, 11 years ago, I bought 40 acres and couldn't get there. And finally one day I just left and went and moved there into a little trailer. The community tried evicting me. It was in the paper. The health department condemned the place. I couldn't afford to bring electricity there and decided to just make it work. Next thing I know, health department's helping me. I'm a regular at the township meetings. I've got all these newspaper ads I'm going to pin up on my house. Hopefully I can start building next year, and they're going to be my accomplishments of reminding you everything I went through to make this dream property work.
So every once in a while, these stories of people getting up in arms about something, they do tend to resolve in good ways.
Well, you know what? I never knew my neighbor in town. We're from South Bend, Indiana, and now I know my neighbors within 2 miles away. It's a completely different world, and all I had to do was give up my TV and, of course, refrigeration. I buy groceries daily.
Okay.
I know. That sounds pretty hillbilly, but I'm telling you, when I leave these McMansions and go home, I have a home now with a 360 view and the birds and the squirrels, and it is the most beautiful thing, and I thought it was going to be taken from me, and I stuck it out. I've been there 5 years and been a registered voter in that neighborhood.
There room for two there, Rusty?
Yeah, it's nice, but I got to tell you, it's discouraging when I see it in the newspaper that these big bad people that I don't even know are coming to get me, and it never really existed. I just had to participate in the community.
Thanks for the call, Rusty, and good luck with the linoleum, and good luck hanging out.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it. Mark Singer, stories like Rusty's. You talk about America as a land of unease. A lot of these stories are just, it seemed to me, stories about people who had a better idea of who they were.
Well, that happens a lot. I mean, one of the things that he's talking about is community. People define communities very narrowly according to the particular interests that they're trying to protect. And I found this when I wrote about people trying to skinny dip in Vermont, or when I wrote about the sons of the Confederate veterans in Shreveport. There is a town in northwest Connecticut, Norfolk, Connecticut, that's having a big fight over whether to put in a luxury golf course. That's actually a very affluent community. The title of that story was The Haves versus the Haves. But every one of those is about some sort of threat to community.
Mark Singer writes about these stories in the U.S. Journal, in the New Yorker. Some of his columns are collected in the new book, Somewhere in America, Under the Radar, with Chicken Warriors, Left-Wing Patriots, Angry Nudists, and others. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you.
And we caught up with Calvin Trillin on vacation in Nova Scotia. His latest book is Obliviously On He Sails, The Bush Administration in Rhyme. You can hear his poetic take on the Democratic Convention later today on All Things Considered. Calvin Trillin, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.